Welcome to the podcast Benzo Tired. I'm your host, Neftel Benesty, and I'm Dutch. Join me on my journey into the world of benzodiazepines, withdrawal, bind, and more. Disclaimer, always consult your physician for medical advice. This is episode 31, Melissa Bond, author of Blood Orange Night, and today it's November 1st, 2023. In this episode, Melissa Bond, a narrative journalist, poet, and matriarch to Salt Lake City's slam scene. The Salt Lake Tribune and the New York Post have both done features on Bond's book Blood Orange Night, her memoir about becoming dependent upon and then withdrawing from benzodiazepines. Blood Orange Night was published by Simon & Schuster in June 2022 and was selected by the New York Times as one of the best audiobooks of 2022. Bond has been featured on PBS Story in the Public Square, Radio West, the podcast Risk, Endeavors, Psychology Unplugged, the New York Times podcast, Radio West, and Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Hi, Melissa. Welcome to Benzo Tired.
Oh my gosh, Neftel, I am so thrilled to talk to you today.
I am so psyched. I've been looking forward to this forever. So, oh gosh. So anyone who does not know you, where does your kind of benzo story begin?
Oh, okay. So my benzo story begins with not knowing a thing about benzos, first of all. Never heard of them, never thought about them, was always like a super healthy athlete, you know, don't like to take medicine kind of person. And I, in the 2000s, late 2000s, I had my first child. Shortly thereafter, I got pregnant with my second one, and I got hit with this insomnia that was like, you know, people talk about like, oh, I woke up for a couple of hours a night and it was really awful. And I'd always thought that was insomnia. But what I encountered was literally sleeping like maybe an hour or two a night for month after month after month, all while having a 6-month-old who was born with Down syndrome and being pregnant. And so that's where the story starts, because after my first trimester, I was prescribed Ambien, which is a Z drug, not a benzo, but very similar in terms of where, you know, the action in the brain. After I delivered my daughter, I cold turkeyed the Ambien, which I realized was not good because it damages the brain's, you know, receptors.
Right.
3 months later, had rebound insomnia that was so bad, and two infants at that time, that I went to see a doctor who was he called himself a wellness doctor. I'm saying that in air quotes. Your listeners can't see this, but And what that meant was he was an MD, but he also practiced a lot of holistic medicines. Used to do acupuncture, but lots of herbs, you know, wanted to get to the root cause of whatever was causing your issue, and sounded great. And he prescribed me in the first appointment 2 milligrams of Ativan, which
is high dose.
High dose, the amount they give people who are having grand mal seizures in the ER. And it went, should I keep going on the story?
Sure. I mean, I already kind of know how it goes, but he really kind of convinces you that it's, you know, you need to get your adrenals well, and you know, and you trust this man, you know, Dr. Amazing.
Dr. Amazing. That's what I call him in the book, because he said, he was like, okay, you had 2 kids back to back. You were an older mom, so your body didn't recover. Your adrenals are shot. We need to make sure you sleep so your adrenals can repair. Once you sleep, your adrenals will fix themselves, and then we don't have to be on this medication anymore. Right. He also told me that the medication was great, not addictive, not an issue. And so at that point, I was like, someone's either going to hit me with a 2x4 or I'm going to take this medication.
Right.
So what happened over the next 6 months, I'm one of those people that apparently metabolize them very quickly. I think a lot of people do. So my brain got very used to the drugs. In the first 2 months, he upped my dose by an additional 2 milligrams to 4 milligrams.
Gosh.
By July of that year, I was at 6 milligrams every single night, doctor prescribed. And I, at that point, was like having friends tell me they think I'm anorexic because I couldn't eat. You know, I'd never been one of those people that people thought was anorexic.
Like, right, I was always right, like, right.
like robust athletic type. And they were like, you're so skinny. And I said, well, I can't eat anything because my, my stomach would seize. And I thought it was like, oh, this is some weird, like I had a C-section. This is some, they rearranged everything weird. Or I explained away all of these symptoms that were arising that made no sense to me. Like what is this like neurological symptom? I'm not able to read as well. I'm not able to remember things from one day to the next. And what I explained away as being sort of a new mom was actually severe withdrawal symptoms that they call interdose withdrawal, because it was such a fast acting benzo. I was having withdrawals in between my doses.
Right. So when you got first got prescribed the Ativan, and the audience doesn't know this now, but did it work for you at first?
So the first night I describe it, I was like, I woke up after 7 hours of sleep and I was like, it was a whole new world. I was like, this is amazing. I feel like I can conquer the world. Like I can teach my son how to sign an Egyptian. Like, you know, like this is incredible. But it really quickly, I would say within a couple of weeks, I was getting 6 hours, then 4 hours, and then 2 hours. And that's why he kept upping the dose. And, you know, and after six, I was feeling so sick that I just, thank goodness there was some part of me that was like, there's something wrong with him just continuing to up my dose. And I was so cognitively compromised at that point, I couldn't even like decide what to do. I was just trying to survive.
Right, right. So when does the moment come for you when you know it's the drug causing your symptoms?
Yeah. So this is like a very dramatic, or at least dramatic for me, moment. So I've got, you know, I'm married at the time, and I'm married to someone who has very, very little bandwidth for anyone who's sick. So it's like the worst possible, you know, so he just checks out emotionally. So he's outside, I'm putting, trying to get the kids to bed. I'm taking my daughter who's like one out of the tub. I put her in her little green froggy towel. I will never forget, I took a step into like getting ready to go into her bedroom. And I've never had the experience of my entire body just going, or no, my leg muscles just going liquid. Like suddenly I am falling like a dead body from a bridge and I can see this corner wall coming at my daughter's head. So I, you know, I do this quick torque and like land and slam my body into the wall so I can protect her. And I'm lying there and I'm like, okay, that's not mama tired. That's not mama sunk. Like something is wrong. I must have MS. I've got multiple sclerosis. No, I've got a brain tumor. Like all, and I'm tracking like cognitive decline, inability to read, lack of balance. And it all makes sense. There's something neurologically that is like undiagnosed. And then 30 seconds later, my leg muscles, boom, they're back as if nothing happened.
Right, right.
And that was the moment all of a sudden, and I had been, your listeners don't know this, but I had been a journalist for years prior to, so investigating, everything was just in my blood, but I had not checked into these drugs because I had been so, you know, after like 9 months of not sleeping, I was like, I don't care if you tell me it's good, I'm going to take
it. Right, right, right.
That's when I opened the computer and found, you know, the Ashton manual and that list of withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah.
And like my sky is falling.
Yeah. Yeah. you describe it so well in your book too. And maybe bring the audience with you how you move on from that point.
Yeah. So the terrifying thing is that, you know, when you find out a drug is causing all of these horrific symptoms and really turning me into someone who's disabled, the first thing I want to do is just get rid of them.
Right.
And everything that I read that's reputable, I'm reading a lot of sites that are in America that are reputable medical sites like PubMed and NIH. And they're all like, well, you know, the efficacy wanes, but whatever you do, don't cold turkey because you can have a fatal seizure or psychosis and end up on your neighbor's roof yelling about the apocalypse, right? Which is also not good.
Right, right. right, right.
So I realize I've got a taper And I think, oh, okay, well, I can do this myself. I'll just cut like a little, and I'm going to start tonight. Like I was so furious and I was so determined to get off that I cut a little piece off one, there were three pills, each 2 milligrams.
Right.
And woke up that night with my daughter crying, went down to her room. And this is the title of the book. It's called Blood yeah. Orange Night, because I had a stroke.
Yeah.
I had yeah. a stroke because of the medication and ended up on the floor, like barely able to move.
Super scary. Yeah.
Super scary. And it was at that point that I started looking for a doctor that could help me taper in a way that wouldn't kill me. And
right.
that took months.
Oh, it took you months. Right. Because you find a Dr. James and a Dr. Kate, but I'm not really sure which one comes first.
Yeah. So Dr. Kate was first, and she was a wonderful internist, but wasn't a specialist in benzodiazepines.
Right.
And she said to me, I don't know how to get you off this other than going really, really slow. And so we tried going really slow for 4 or 5 months, and we would go down and my withdrawals would be so severe, and I'm still trying to like parent full time and like thinking that maybe I can write a little bit, which
right.
didn't happen.
Right, right.
I could barely like pour a glass of milk. But so we try for 5 months. It doesn't work. So she looks through all of her contacts throughout the U.S. even. And I send out the word to all of my friends and say, do you know anyone that knows specifically about benzodiazepines?
Right. And
she actually, this is scary now. This was 2010, so 13 years ago. She could not find anyone that knew very much about them at that time. Somehow, I found two friends that both said, there's this guy, Dr. James, and he knows more about benzos than anyone we know, and he's great. We will get you in. And that was my act of grace. That was like the angels saying, like, let's make sure she doesn't die.
And right, right. And he was kind of flying under the radar as a GP, but kind of having a specialism, right? Maybe you can
hear the audience a bit. Yeah, so I would not have found him if I was looking for him on the internet, because he had told me, because of insurance issues and, and people's needs, he could serve people better flying under the radar, like you said.
Right, right, right. So you come at Dr. James, and I mean, during all of this, your life is just kind of collapsing. Your husband is just so president absence almost, when you're at home and you're like dying, surviving, taking care of your kids, two young infants. And he's just out. And it's kind of like the feeling that I get from reading the book is that he's kind of bothered that you're not well.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, he's got his stuff around that,
And yeah.
I've worked really hard to understand that, like, for whatever reason, it was too hard for him to navigate. So he literally did check out and would just get very frustrated. And it is hard to understand because there's no tumor to point to. There's no lab test that says, yes, she's dying. There's just this subjective experience of, I feel like there is a fire in my head and under my skin and I can barely function. And so for him, the abstraction of it was too much. So he checked out. So I did feel very alone in like, I'm raising these kids and I am like having seizures, and he just turned blind. He just turned
right,
blind.
Right. So you find Dr. James, and I do remember reading that you at some point you want to go with the Ashton manual and try to switch to Valium.
Yes.
Maybe you can share the audience a little bit with that.
So one of the things that he told me, and this is part of the protocol that Dr. Ashton put together, which is you switch entirely over to Valium or to the longer acting benzodiazepine. So you don't have that inner dose withdrawal. He tells me, I want you to switch over from 6 milligrams of Ativan to 60 milligrams of Valium in one night. Just do the switch. He said, it's going to be weird. But you'll survive. Like he literally said
right.
I remember that night my dreams were like blood and carnage. Like it was literally like seeing my how old was he? Two, maybe? My two-year-old son like walking with like his leg was broken and like the bone was poking through. Like
oh my God.
It was like some horror show.
Right.
But I woke up in the morning and I was like, okay, I'm alive.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
so crazy that we are getting off these doctor prescribed drugs and we're just grateful that we're alive each step of the way.
Definitely. Definitely. And yeah. you describe your whole taper in your book so well. And it's just, you know, what I also really love about your book, it's the benzo taper, it's the benzodiazepines, but everything around it, you know, being a mother, still right. having your heart of poetry and your soul is there. And you're really describing, it feels like you're taking me by the hand and showing me whatever happens in that lifetime where you,
yeah.
you know, where you write your book. So like I told Melissa before, like I read your book six times because you're such a good writer. Mm-hmm. And it was enjoyable. And what I also like I was amidst, you know, benzo withdrawal and you know how that can be like, and then you're like reading through the horrors. And then there's like jokes and then there's like things that would just brighten me up. Like, you know, the craziness that we can have due to the insomnia. And you're talking about Kim Jong-un and I'm like, oh my God, I'm laughing. I'm like deathly ill and I'm laughing because I understand you and I yes. feel you. And it's yes. so relatable, especially when it comes to the topic of just benzo withdrawal and insomnia, how that will fuck you up. So yeah, I just
break yeah. you into a million pieces.
Exactly. So you start this taper, that's like a long way to go from 60 milligrams of Valium.
Yeah.
So can you share with the audience a little bit about how your taper went originally?
Yeah. So, you know, there are these waves that you go through. So at first, you know, like we took several months to kind of get everything ready because I wanted to protect my kids. And I feel like they're gifts of grace that I was given in periodically throughout the way. One of them was actually meeting this Tibetan Lama who was also a social worker who knew a lot about benzos and who sat me down and said, look, this is going to be the worst thing you've ever been through. It's worse than heroin withdrawal. Like it's the worst thing I've ever seen. You are going to need to find a place where you can withdraw and not feel like you're trying to hold yourself up to protect your kids
right.
or your husband at the time. And he said, do you have friends that you could stay with for like 4 to 6 months? And to me, that seemed like the most crazy, like what? I've got two infants, you know, or, you know, sort of, what do we call them? Toddlers at that time, 1 and 2.
Right.
And it just seemed like the craziest idea. But he said, really, I think globally, we do not have a system that supports a protracted withdrawal. You have to come up with something where you put supports in place for your family, financially, like all of these things, and for you to be able to really crawl into that hole of withdrawal and just focus on being able to like, what do I need to do to feel better so I can at least function a little?
Yeah, so definitely.
Yeah. So we put the kids in daycare. I unbelievably found two friends who are one of us is a psychiatrist. The other one is just a great humanist and artist. And they're like parents to me. And they said, oh yeah, you can stay with us. Like I would. And so I would kind of had my home there. And then I would go home and try to make it for the kids. I would be there first thing in the morning before they woke up. I would make them breakfast. I would, you know, take them to daycare. And then I would go to my other withdrawal home. It was right. like an outpatient kind of thing.
Well, I think, you know, especially in those times and less information than we have now, I think yeah. that was one of the most creative, the best advice that someone could give you, even yeah. though, it, you know, for maybe an unquote regular person, it doesn't make any sense that you would stay somewhere else. But I, you know, you can tell the audience, but I think it was a really good solution to this problem because I agree with you. We need a cocoon. You know, we're so focused on healing and, you know, we're having seizures and we don't know when we're going to have them and we don't know when we're going to sleep. So yeah. it's nice to have, and especially like stress isn't really good for us. That's going to be hard as a parent perhaps, but I think it really worked out for you.
And for me, it was such a relief to know, like, okay, I know my kids are okay. I know that, like, they on, the kind of bracketed ends of the day, they're going to be taken care of. I can pace kind of the withdrawals, or if I'm having a really bad time, we even brought in my mother-in-law to kind of
Right.
support the workings of the household. So I knew they would be taken care of. And if I was having a really horrible day where I'm just racked with seizures or nosebleeds or whatever, I could say, I can't come home tonight,
Right.
and protect them from seeing something like that because they wouldn't be able to understand it. So that
Right.
was really important to me. And then also be able to figure out, like, okay, what do I do when there's a seizure? What do I do
Right.
when my vision goes? What do I do when these various, and like start to develop kind of a toolkit to manage the withdrawals as I go through.
Right. Now there comes a moment in the book, and this is also, I'm gonna try to not cry because I think you're so brave, and you have a special needs kiddo, which is a thing. But at some point, he's unable to go to daycare anymore because they just couldn't find it, just wasn't a match anymore. They tried, and it
They
kind
tried.
of, leads into you coming back, right, to the house.
So it's 6 months in, this unbelievable daycare. What we didn't know at the time is that he also has autism. So that was really, really making it challenging for them to work with 30 normal, neurotypical kiddos, and then one who's very not neurotypical, and be able to give. And so he's trying to escape, basically. They're installing doors. He's hypersensitive to noise, and you get a room full of 30 kids or 15 kids, and he's like acting out. So, like you said, they said, "We have tried everything. We're so sorry. We just can't handle him anymore." And so, yeah, so I moved back home. And at this point, my relationship with my now ex-husband was just like the stress overload was
Right.
too much. And so I'm trying to sort of like, okay, my boy needs me. I'm going to be here day to day. And I say, like, I'm going to rock this titration thing. Like, I'm going to be folding underwear and
I
like,
read it, yeah.
like
And you were
grinding it
so
out.
mo I mean, like everyone else, you're so motivated. Like you want to
Yes.
come off and we're gonna do it, and we've already been through such
We did
hell,
it.
so we're just gonna do it.
Yep.
It's because
Yep.
you've
And I.
tapered down to five at some point. Right, which was nowhere easy. But something that we may want to share here is that you have horrible symptoms, even more horrible when you come down from five.
So when I start going lower than five, and also the context, I think the added stress.
Right.
I think I might have even gotten down to like 2.8 or 3.1 or something like that, but it was unsustainable. Like I literally, my intestines were shutting down. I stopped sleeping. I started having seizures again. And I just thought, this is not, like, it's not working. I can't live every day like this. And so I remember after, it seemed like it was like another 4 months that I tried that. And I talked with Dr. James, and he said, I think your brain, like your level of stress right now, your brain is obviously just not acclimating. And the last several milligrams are the hardest. We don't really know why. They might have a sense of why now. I'm not really sure. I haven't looked into the medical literature about that yet, but they're very, very difficult. And so he said, I think if you held it five, you're not having additional symptoms. You won't have interdose withdrawal.
Right.
I'm okay with that. And
Right.
so I went back up to five, totally stabilized, and felt like a normal person for the first time in 5 years.
Right. Well, the literature nowadays, there's this really cool document, and I discuss it over and over on the podcast, is called the Colorado Deprescribing Guidance. BIC is a part of that, doctors, the people with lived experience. And I spoke to this woman in the UK. And there are cases of people that just can't move on or get down from a certain level of Valium, for example. Like they hold it on five or on four. And every case is so unique, as you know, but some people just have, or maybe it's not the time yet. Maybe they would have to long hold. Because of your book, I got this first concept of long holding, but it's been around because once I read your book and I was still active on benzo buddies at the time, and I just Googled like or long holding. And there were people that did that, you know, they got off in the end, you know, or some just held indefinitely. That's what I say on a DE Foster's podcast. I'm holding indefinitely on 5 until I'm ready to restart my taper. Yeah. For some people, it just works. And some people are very positive about it. And some people may have other opinions, but it does happen. It does happen. And like you're writing your book, for some odd reason, and I don't know why this is, but it's that 5 milligram value mark that seems to be a thing.
It's a thing. And the way I think about it in my head that makes sense, it's a very graphic image, but it feels like the drugs themselves are like fish hooks. And you get fish hooks into a fish and you don't pull that sucker because you're going to rip everything to shreds.
Right.
And it's almost like you get as far as you can, and then they're the ones that are really in deep. And you have to kind of wait, and like you may be able to get them out and you may not.
Right.
You know, and we're just not sure why the brain can't quite fully recover. And it is, my understanding is there are those structural changes in the brain, and it may be that you have those GABA receptors that you just can't come fully back online again, period.
Right. I think there's a consensus about that. You know, I don't think I'll ever, you know, I don't know about my future. I don't know about yours, but you know, I will probably never be the same again. Maybe I'll never have 8 hours uninterrupted sleep again, but that is acceptable for me now. I think the biggest thing for me was knowing all about this and getting educated. I think for the whole benzo community, I would recommend that, get educated. One more thing that I want to touch on in the book, something that I want to commend you for as well, is, I mean, a lot happens in the book, y'all. Y'all got to read it, but a lot happens. But there is this part where you really are pissed and you really are trying to make a difference. You're blogging. Yeah. And at some point you get ABC to come to your house.
Yes.
And I'm not sure what you want to share on that, but you really try to make a change. You really try to like warn the world, like me, hey y'all, this is some bad shit. You know, this is worse than heroin and benzos are bad. You know, maybe you want to share because you really tried hard.
Oh my gosh.
About the ABC thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I got contacted by one of the producers at ABC with Diane Sawyer. She said, you know, I'm really interested in this because a personal story. My nephew got put on them. It was a horrible experience. I'd really love to hear your experience. We've read your blogs, blah, blah, blah. So they come out. They fly out this another producer. She has to like step out for some family reason. This other producer comes in. They fly out a correspondent from LA. You know, it's the whole thing. They do the interview. It takes 2 days. And, you know, and it's a weird thing to put yourself, to make the decision to put yourself on national television for something that I still felt a lot of like tendrils of shame about, like, could I have done something to not get dependent upon these? Should I have done this? Should I have done that? Like, you know, how could this have happened to me? And so I had to kind of set that aside and say, you know, if this happened to me, someone who was like drinking wheatgrass juice in high school, you know, and like climbing mountains in Thailand, like who was very like focused on health, if this happened to me, then I'm not the only one. And it is worth me setting my ego aside and saying, okay, I'll deal with kind of my issues of like shame and discomfort or whatever, but I need to let people know, like, because if there are other people like me, I want to let them know what I've learned about how to get off, what these drugs do. So they film for 2 days. It's right before the Olympics, 2012?
I can't remember exactly, but I know Katy Perry, you got bumped by Katy Perry.
I got bumped by Katy Perry. And so the first night we're down there, I'm with my, like, I'm texting a friend. We're like, we have popcorn.
Yes.
We're like, you know, like piece by piece. And I, you know, Diane Sawyer was known for being this long form investigative reporter when she first started out on 60 Minutes. But her ABC, the way they've formatted news shows now, are they're like these 2-3 minute segments. So I'm watching like, okay, there's really, really bad water in West Virginia and they're telling the pregnant women not to drink the water. Oh my gosh. Okay. And then there are fires in California. Okay. And then, oh my gosh, there's an orchestra in China that is playing Katy Perry's Roar.
Yeah. And there was like about Putin and about homophobic stuff happening.
Yes.
And then that is very American. I went to the US once and that is very American thing. We don't have that here. It's like every 5 minutes, like when you're watching TV, there is commercials.
Right.
But also what was shocking to me, all the drug commercials, all the ads,
Oh
side
my.
effects may kill you, your dick will drop off, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, is it normal here? I'm like, what the hell?
So crazy. And I was like, huh, I wonder if they'll really run something that is so, you know, I try not to, it's not an indictment of the pharmaceutical industry, and yet it is because they're part of the system. We have a system that is broken. We have a system that's based on capitalist enterprises. It's for profit. And so it does not look to the best interests of the patient. And that is just part of our system. It's very broken. And so, you know, of course, they're getting money from pharmaceuticals running ads. None of them were benzos, thank goodness. It was mostly erectile dysfunction and indigestion,
Right,
which
right,
was
right.
hilarious.
Right, right.
But they never ran the piece.
And you
I
asked
called.
for that material and it was gone. Such a
And
waste. Yeah.
what they told me was that the producer of the piece, if it's not run, the producer of the piece gets to hold on to the actual footage. And months later, I was looking through LinkedIn and I found that the producer had taken a job with a pharmaceutical company.
Right.
Now, I can't make any kind of assertions about what that means, but it was
Right.
very, very odd.
A very ironic, at least.
Yes.
So, Melissa, can you share with the audience how the creative process of writing your book, Blood Orange Night, was?
Yeah. So as you would imagine, there's like the dark side of like going through it again. The therapeutic side of like kind of processing like what just happened. And
Right.
then there was the light side, which for me is when you take something so painful and you try to turn it into something beautiful. So this transmutation, because I knew my goal in making this book was to not just bring information to light, because you know a number of people have written books about benzos and how they got off and some suggestions, but I wanted to create something that would bring people through the experience, but also have an element of beauty that would really draw them in. So it would be a book not just for benzo users, but that would be something that people would want to read because we all go through times that test us that we think, I don't know if I'm going to survive this. And if you haven't, you likely will at some point. And well, you know, not necessarily benzos, but you know,
Right.
grief and loss and illness. It's part of being human. And I wanted to like expand my experience into that sensibility that we become either in much better humans as a result, or we become bitter dried raisins.
Right,
I
right,
was
right.
not going to become a bitter dried raisin.
Right. So tell me how it was like when you published your book, because I think I must have been like one of the, I mean, I like to think that I was one of the first ones that bought it, but I know it came out in, I think, July 2022,
June 2022.
June. And how did that go for you?
Oh my gosh. It was, you know, it was honestly, it was a dream come true. One of the things that is very weird that I still can't, I've got an idea of why this is, but I'd been a writer and a poet my entire
Yeah.
life in terms of like, you know, my self-identity. But I'd always felt like I wasn't good enough. You know, I had these writers that I viewed as being, you know, my dream writers. And I just felt like, well, I would try to publish every couple of years and I would get rejected. And then I would sort of go back into my hole, you know. And so I struggled with like my deep insecurities about my own work and whether I could really make it on a large scale. And somehow, like, going through the hell of benzo withdrawal, it was so bad. It was almost like there is nothing that is going to stop me at this point, you know? So, I doing all of the work that you have to do to get a really prominent agent and a prominent publisher. Like, that was just, I didn't have any problems with my own feelings of insecurity because it felt so important to get it out, not just for me, but for other people.
Right, right.
And so when it was published, it was, I mean, to say it was a dream come true feels like a cliche, but it really was. It felt so gratifying to have something that I felt was beautiful that would also be of service to other people that were suffering.
And it got picked up really well. Wasn't it like in the top 10 New York Post something?
Yeah, I know that. So it's been in the New York Times several times. And I know they picked it as their, like, one of their top six audiobooks of 2022.
Right, right. How was that like to do the audio version of your book?
It was actually a beautiful experience. Like, the people I worked with were incredible. But there were also times where, you know, like, how many times have I read this thing? Like, I've edited it. Like 11 times. So I've read it ad nauseum. Still, I'm reading it and I'm getting choked up. And like the Simon & Schuster woman, who I called Pillow Talk because she had the softest voice. Like, I wanted to lay down on her voice. She was so beautiful. She would say, Melissa, it's okay. You know, this is, she was like, just take your time, take a minute. Cause I would be like, you know? Like,
right. So, and you added a new chapter and a new cover. The cover is awesome. I just love that. I mean, both covers, because I know the history behind that first cover, you know, it's like when you take that picture and you've lost so much weight. So it's very meaningful. And the second one is like really just awesome and bold. I love it that, you know, very there's bold. Like capsules in there. I love it. So how did, because there is kind of like a gap within the bonus chapter that was like years later after you completed the book. So in a way you kind of republished or something, but, what kind of responses did you get from your book? What the ones that you find lovely, as you will, like, oh, that was really a cool response to my book.
You know, I think the ones that are the most touching for me, are the ones that point to the reason that I wrote it. You know, that people that have said, like, when I was going through it, I was looking for a candle in the dark. I was looking for someone who had been through what I had been through, so I didn't feel crazy. So I didn't feel like, you know, and that I could manage, like, the shame and, like, hey, you know, when this crazy thing happens, did you ever have that, you know, to have? Because when you have a kind of, you know, this is a chronic illness. It is months and months, if not years. And there's no landscape, especially back then, there was no landscape. There was no one that I found right away that was like, oh yeah, I've been through that. There's a support group right down the street. Like, there was nothing like that.
Right.
So to have people say like, wow, I've been having all of these experiences and I had no idea it was the benzos, or you've explained to me what happened to my mom or my brother or my son. And I have so much like it touched my heart. Those are the ones that just make me cry, you know, like it's made a difference in someone's life and given them like a balm or like a soothing or at least a hope, you know, that they can make it through.
Right. And I mean, you really helped me in my journey. So thank you for that.
My gosh.
And I'm like super grateful. And it was like the right timing, kind of like a divine sort of timing. It was so surreal how it happened, because I heard you on Geraldine's podcast and I was like, I need to read this book. And it just gave me new perspective. It gave me hope and just so much. It was the first, I mean, I read another book, but that was kind of, you know, a man wrote it and it was like, this is how my taper went. This were my symptoms. The end, kind of, you know, kind of like being black and white over here. But, and then your book is, this is a memoir. This is a life story about this woman who has, it's just your life. It's just so intimate as well. And you touched on, you are so observant. That's also something that I wanted to comment and give you compliments to, like everything that's happening in your surroundings, especially with your ex-husband, even though you're going through this awful journey, you have such an eye for details and that is just a beautiful thing. Yeah. So in terms of how are you doing now? Do you have any projects that you would like to share with the audience?
Yeah. Well, you know, so it's incredible to feel good. So incredible to feel good. Right. I have a full-time job. My kids are 14 and 15 now, which is unbelievable. And you know, so of course, like my dream is to be a full-time writer. I still have my day job. I am working on, I've actually got two books that are in the pipes. And by that, I mean, like my agent really loves one, which we're talking about possibly being a follow-on to Blood Orange Night. We have to, the way it works is you send it to your agent. If the agent gives the thumbs up, then you send it to your editor and they decide if they want to pick it up. So we're not at that point yet. So I can't promise anything, but
right.
I think it'll be something she'll like. And then I have a book of fiction, Naftal, which is just wild.
Cool.
That I've been working on for the last number of years that I love, but it's kind of gotten pushed aside by this follow on to Blood Orange Night. But hopefully not for too long. So
right.
I'm thinking in the next year, there should be something.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'll add everything in the show notes, but to people just listening in their cars or whatever, where can people find you?
So my website is www.melissaabond.com. And my Instagram handle is @MelissaBAuthor.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And to wrap up the show, I always ask all my guests if they would, you know, there are people that are listening that are currently in withdrawal, unfortunately. Any words of wisdom that you would like to share?
Absolutely. There are going to be innumerable days that you think it will never end. And that is part of the process. And part of you getting better is you finding ways to soothe yourself when you don't think you can make it. Because that is part of it. And I had numerous days where I was like, I should just lock myself in a dark woods somewhere and be done with it. And I'm so glad that I held on because it was so slow, but there are innumerable people that have gone before you and we've been through it and we will support you. And it is possible.
Thank you.
So hang on.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Thank you for your time.
Oh my gosh, it's been a delight.
I'm being in touch. Definitely. Thank you for listening to the episode. Be well, be safe. Remember, it's not a race. And don't forget to subscribe and rate the show.